You're listening to Greater LA from KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and the places of Southern California. Hi, I'm Steve Chitakis. That's the S-Bahn tram in Berlin, Germany. Helga Fogelson, now a longtime Angelino, rode a tram on those same tracks with her dad after Kristallnacht. That's the night of broken glass in 1938. That's when Nazis burned and destroyed synagogues and Jewish businesses, including that of Hilda's dad. He wanted to show 12-year-old Hilda and her sisters what the Nazis had done.
And we went all through Berlin, and we saw all the Jewish stores, the windows smashed in. That was really something. And my father said, "Do you remember this? If you ever get out of here, you tell people about it."
Obviously, Hilda did get out. And like Hilda, the only Holocaust survivors remaining were children at the time. Hilda worries if they don't share their stories, what happened in Nazi Germany could happen again, especially in light of the recent rise in anti-Semitism.
When things go bad, they gotta blame somebody. They blame the Jews. Well, we have to fight it.
Part of that fight is remembering. That's where reporter Susan Vallett picks up the story.
He's driving from Santa Barbara.
Hilda, who's now 96, sits with her son, George Fogelson, in a small den off the kitchen of her Studio City home. We're waiting for Michael Wolf, who was a baby who escaped Germany on the same train as Hilda.
This is my mother, Hilda.
Hello, Hilda.
Hello. Hello.
Michael.
This is Michael.
Michael and his wife come inside. Everyone sits around the dining room table for some coffee und Kuchen.
I made Lebkuchen.
Oh, okay.
Do you know what that is?
No.
You don't know what Lebkuchen
no.
is?
No.
It's a German Christmas cookie that her mother always made at the holidays.
They start sharing stories over the gingerbread-like goodies. Hilda, then Hilda Anker, remembers Berlin fondly. But when the Nazis came to power in 1933, it started to get harder and harder to live. Hilda remembers an incident with a neighbor girl she used to play with.
She said to me, "From now on, I'm not going to play with you anymore." And I said, "But why? I didn't do anything, you know." She said, "Yeah, but you're Jewish." And I went home and I said, "My dad, what does it mean you're Jewish?" I didn't even know, you know.
Other kids in the neighborhood became mean.
In the winter, they took a rock, and then they put snow around it, and they tried to hit us, the little Nazi boys.
Hilda recalls going to a couple of Hitler parades. She says one time, she and her cousin purposely didn't salute as their own act of defiance. And then another time...
Remember Mussolini? And Hitler going together, and they stood there like that.
Hilda waves her hand to indicate the salute.
I was thinking if I would have had a gun, I could have killed them. But I guess there was so much security, you know.
George says the adults called a family meeting in 1936 and made a decision.
We need to sell all our real estate holdings. We need to start selling our homes. We have to sell our two farms, and we need to get the hell out of here and get as far away as we can.
Still, some of the family was hesitant. George says his grandfather passed up a chance to leave earlier because he figured he was a good German, so he would be safe.
And then when it came down to it, my grandparents, after Kristallnacht, they said, "If we can't save ourselves, we have to save the children."
Hilda's parents paid to get her and her sisters onto the Kinder transport. That's when Jewish groups and others worked together to send about 10,000 Jewish children to safety between November of 1938 and September of 1939, when World War II began. Hilda and her two sisters left in June of 1939. George says the Germans controlled the train schedules, but still let the children leave.
They purposely put the departure very early in the morning before the start of work because they didn't want the public to see these Jewish children having to leave and their parents carrying on. And that's why they wouldn't let the parents on the same platform to say goodbye.
The parents didn't know if they'd ever see their kids again. In many cases, they didn't. Hilda says her parents treated it as though they were going on a school trip. Michael Wolf, the 86-year-old who just arrived at Hilda's house, was there too. Michael doesn't remember much about Germany or his journey to safety. He wasn't quite 3 years old when his mom was able to get him on the Kinder transport. Michael's mom had to hand him off to a stranger, as he tells George.
And I met Mrs. Weiss in the 80s in Orange County. And she remembered that I was at the Liverpool station and I was screaming and hugging her because she was the only one that spoke German.
Michael's mom arranged for a friend, Mrs. Weiss, to pick him up in London. The two reconnected much later in California.
I don't remember that boat at all.
It's terrible. I mean, a not yet three-year-old is just on a boat unsupervised.
Well, she gave me to a 15-year-old girl and whoever was, I guess, took care of me.
Michael was eventually reunited with his dad, and they eventually made their way to Bolivia to reunite with his mom, who'd also made it out. It took them more than a decade to make their way to the United States. Michael's family story echoes that of Hilda's.
When my mother left, she wanted her sister and her father to go with her, and they wouldn't leave. My grandfather says, I fought in World War I, they're not going to do anything to me. Yeah, well, he ended up in Theresienstadt in a ghetto, so we don't know what happened to him. My aunt was gassed at Auschwitz. We know that.
Michael says they didn't find out where or how his grandfather died until 1992, decades later. Some other members of his family made it out to various locations.
And they had to change their name. Wolf was too German. They all changed their names.
About a year after Hilda and her sisters left on the Kinder transport, her parents barely made it out of Germany, and the Anker family made its way to California in the early 1940s. Hilda's parents bought a chicken farm in Van Nuys, and despite everything that happened to them, Hilda's dad still hung on to his German identity.
My dad was a really proud German. Too bad. I don't know why he was like that.
Identity is complicated, especially for refugees. Hilda says her family actually had a Christmas tree when they were in Germany, even though they were Jewish. But once they got to the U.S., that stopped. Hilda grew up culturally Jewish, but once she got to America, she became more involved in the religious side of Judaism, becoming active at her local synagogue and active in telling her story. But for her son, George, it's about later generations carrying that torch and making sure no one forgets, as he tells his mom and Michael.
It's up to us to tell your story, and that's what we're trying to do.
In hopes that it won't happen again to Jews or anyone else. For KCRW, I'm Susan Vallett.
Thank you.
I wish you well.
Coming up, right-wing extremism is alive and well in Southern California. Hear one reporter's tale of what she found when it comes to militias and advocates of overthrowing the government right here in Greater LA. Hope you'll stick around after this quick break.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
More now of Greater LA from KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. It's been 30 years since the standoff at the Branch Davidian compound near Waco, where a Texas cult leader named David Koresh had been stockpiling what the federal government said were illegal weapons. His confrontation with the FBI and alcohol, tobacco, and firearms left four agents dead. Then there was a near two-month standoff that culminated in disaster.
Under the blistering Texas sun, investigators comb the smoldering remains of the Branch Davidian compound. More than 80 people are believed to have died in yesterday's fiery conclusion to the 51-day siege, 24 of them children.
Events like that one and another in Ruby Ridge, Idaho a year earlier, even the January 6th insurrection at the U.S. Capitol in 2021, They're all examples of a growing movement driven by echo chambers and now, of course, today, internet conspiracy theories. While radicalization takes many political forms, it's especially prevalent on the modern American right, with anti-government movements such as QAnon, the Proud Boys, the Three Percenters, the Oath Keepers, all motivated by elaborate myths about globalists, secret cabals, and a perceived need to take the country back. Journalist Antonia Hitchens covered one of those groups here in Southern California for The Atlantic magazine called People's Rights. And Antonia joins us right now. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks so much for having me.
What does the group People's Rights stand for, by the way? What rights are they talking about?
So People's Rights, just before we kind of get to Southern California, they're founded by Ammon Bundy, who led the standoff in Malheur in Oregon in 2016, which I think, you know, is very much in conversation with Waco and Ruby Ridge.
Son of Clive and Bundy, right, who also had a standoff in Nevada.
Yes, in Bunkerville. And I think, you know, many people do draw that kind of through line from Bunkerville to Malheur to January 6th, but back to People's Rights. So Ammon, in 2020, actually just before the pandemic, decides to start this group, People's Rights, which is sort of deeply amorphous in its aims. And he kind of wants to gather a bunch of people who would be ready to, as they put it, unite to defend freedom whenever that becomes necessary. So I think they kind of imagine it as this ability to stand up for their neighbors, to fight government tyranny and overreach when the Constitution is no longer being respected, again, in their view. And then if you kind of match cut 2 years, that group is in every state in America and has a huge presence in Southern California.
In your Atlantic article, you refer to the organization as the Uber of militias. What does that mean? Like you call them and they'll come to you?
Yeah. So the idea as they conceive it is that if, for example, you're asked to put a mask on in a public library or if somebody tells your kid they have to get the vaccine, you can't rely anymore on kind of traditional policing, as it were. You can rely on People's Rights. And, you know, I think in the article I mention, one of the members calls it like the bat phone. So you'll have either a signal thread or an SMS thread saying, hey, we need help. You know, our liberty's being threatened, which in practice can kind of play out in a number of different ways. But I think their idea is that at any moment you can have kind of a micro standoff. So sort of a Malheur standoff, but, you know, on a street corner because somebody asked you for your vaccine card.
You actually went to several chapter meetings for the organization in L.A. What were those meetings like?
Yeah, so I spent a good amount of time with the group, and the meetings were, I think, they kind of get to the heart of what's interesting about a group like this, which is that they feel sort of deeply innocuous and non-threatening and, you know, frankly, rather tedious, much like if you've been to something like a DSA meeting, a Democratic Socialist of America, kind of mired in this procedural bureaucracy. People are passing out petitions to recall a judge. People are giving you leaflets for their interpretation of the Constitution. But what's interesting is that I think for the most part in the fall when I was spending time with them, their main focus had become getting people elected to local office. What I noticed in groups like this is that they were kind of trying to reframe this notion of anti-government militias to mean, okay, we're going to try and become the new state senator. We're going to try and become the new Parks and Rec guy. So a lot of the meetings actually centered on kind of what can we do to help get this candidate elected in whether it's West Covina or even like a district in Los Angeles on the east side. They had all these candidates who kind of encapsulated their worldview and who they hoped could kind of get that turned into actual institutional power after the midterms.
Well, speaking of people who are running for office and also, you know, you talked about West Covina. You talked to this guy named Vincent Tsai, who's a sheriff's deputy, was suspended by the sheriff's department for defying COVID protocol. He was a candidate for California State Senate, actually got like 42% of the vote, right? I mean, what role do you think groups like People's Rights are playing in California politics? Because this is a guy you talked to who was a part of this group.
Yeah, I think if you look down the line at the candidates that People's Rights had running for office, whether it's for state senate, whether it's for something like, you know, Parks and Rec board. A lot of them, even if they weren't ultimately successful, they were getting a significant portion of the vote, which I think speaks to how many people are, you know, just fed up with the status quo and the two-party system and want to have candidates who represent views that, you know, to many people might seem extreme or fringe, but again, they're actually capturing a lot of people at the ballot box.
Did you come away with, Antonia, feeling like these groups represent a serious threat or not really? That, you know, this is Southern California. I mean, they may be a threat somewhere else, but maybe not here. I don't know. I mean, it seems like in different places there are different kinds of folks like this, right?
Yeah, no, it's the kind of threat assessment aspect is a tricky part of the subject because, you know, you have many experts who I think look at all of these groups almost as the same and they say, you know, these are dangerous far-right militias and we have to take them seriously. But I think also in terms of Southern California, if you look at the tangible reality, you know, the stuff we're talking about is, as they describe it, at its most intense, a text message about, you know, somebody having to wear a mask in a library. So it's hard for me at times to put that in conversation with something like storming the Capitol. And I do think in the piece I mention, Tasha Adams, who's the estranged ex-wife of Stuart Rhodes, and she talks about how most of the members of the Oath Keepers who kind of joined the group, they just wanted to have like a membership card and access to a website and maybe go to a little gathering once a year. These aren't people who are kind of slinging guns and wearing tactical gear and waiting to do a violent attack. For the most part, I think they're looking for some kind of sense of social cohesion. But of course, at the fringier edges of that, there are people who, you know, very much want to have an insurrection or, you know, something else.
Antonia Hitchens, a journalist whose most recent Atlantic article is titled Like Uber, but for militias. We have a link at our website. Antonia, thanks for coming on and talking with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Onward now with Greater LA from KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Climate change is top of mind for a lot of folks these days as atmospheric rivers have brought so much rain to Southern California, and with it, evacuations and road closings and floods and mudslides. Well, in an upcoming show at the Anat Ebgi Gallery, one local artist is addressing climate change through her SoCal-focused work. Jessica Taylor Bellamy uses screen printing, animation, video to look at LA's political, social, and environmental structures. And she's with us today to talk about that show that's coming up. Jessica, welcome to you.
Hi, Steve. Thank you so much.
And in the interest of full disclosure, Jessica used to work with us here at KCRW, where we got to see a lot of her work. And I was always, Jess, in awe of your talent as an artist. But this is more deliberate than anything that we saw. I mean, you're actually putting an emphasis on climate change, right?
Yes. Well, thank you so much. And I am working with climate change, and I'm working it in a different way that I think has a lot of familiarity to the city, but also is something that is based on sort of real events and some of the dystopic news we hear, also met with fantasy and a little bit of hope and optimism.
I mean, I see a lot of the colors that you use. I'm looking at the pieces right now, and I mean, the colors are darker, right? So, and then you see like clippings of newspapers or articles that talk about the gravity of climate change. How did you manage to put all that together?
Well, I'm sort of a hoarder with information, and I'm always collecting sort of data and stories that interest me about climate change. And right now, the LA Times has been a really good vessel or framing device, and I've just been collecting, you know, stories about fires, stories about water quality, things that seem sort of innocuous, and then weaving those back together and then sort of combining that data with my own data, which is photos and videos of the city since I'm from here. And I'm just constantly capturing sort of that like everyday incremental change. And then when I weave those stories about temperature charts or climate change together with paint and with screen printing, what you get is something that has this like reality without the exact realism. I'm trying to capture the built environment of the city and seeing what sort of ecology changes we can feel while we're living in a city.
One of the pieces we're going to have up on our website is called Proving Ground. And I, if you wouldn't mind just describing it for folks who are listening, maybe talk a little bit about how you express your thoughts about climate change in the piece.
It's sort of like a little moment that maybe is roadside, these weeds that we maybe don't pay attention to, which still are part of our ecology in Southern California. And then on top of it are, and interwoven are these stories about, I think they came from last year's paper and this year's paper in the LA Times, about fire and drought, and sort of like this idea that California is the proving ground sometimes for the rest of the country. And if things go well here, maybe there's hope. And if they don't, then we're all going to have some sort of, you know, major disaster. And there's a moon. There's an evening sunset with those dark colors you were mentioning. And it's something that's legible. But again, you can't really get the full story. You sort of have to take yourself into the environment of knowing what some of these words are leading you to and knowing what feeling interwoven with nature can basically look like in a painting. So doing things that maybe actually reading or hearing the news can't do when you mix it with actually experiencing living here and growing up with climate change in Southern California.
I wonder, as an artist, you know, because I know a lot of artists, and they talk a lot about looking to the future and trying to exhibit, you know, their idea of the future. And if you've got this sort of thing lurking, you know, where we're not so sure about the future, that can be daunting as an artist, can't it? And maybe even limiting.
It's overwhelming, but what's great is to kind of look into the past. And that's where I love, you know, archiving and like my political science background and just this, that looking to the past and then speculating about the future has actually been really fruitful. I've sort of looked at the history of redlining maps versus gentrification neighborhoods versus how much shade a certain neighborhood has.
By trees, right? Yeah.
Yes, by trees, like the canopy. And that actually spawned an entire series of work, painting and video, where I spoke to my family member, recorded their memories about growing up in Inglewood in 1971, and in the same house that they've been in for like almost 50 years, how the neighborhood has changed from more rural to, you know, what it is now. And that's basically spawned an entire series of work about just the land change and like the built environment and how someone like me can try to speculate the future based on what's happened in the past. Things that maybe seemed like they were negative in the past, we've made changes. And one of those big things is even like the urban canopy in Los Angeles planting more trees. So lots of nerdy things and very dense information go into the paintings, but they're all sort of parsed out into their own piece.
It's beautiful work, Jessica. It really is. And I want to thank you for coming on and talking about it. Jessica Taylor Bellamy, her first solo show up at the Anat Ebge Gallery over in the Mid-Wilshire area. It starts January 21st. So nice to talk to you, by the way, Jess.
And so great.
Yeah, and we will have some of your work, by the way, at our website, kcrw.com/GLA. That's going to do it for us today. Tomorrow, the local government took away their valuable beachfront land, but nearly a century later, L.A. County gave it back to the Bruce family. Now, the Bruce family selling it back to the county for millions of dollars. An update on that story tomorrow and the work of California's Reparations Task Force tomorrow right here on Greater L.A. What's on your mind? Have a story idea for us? Let us know at the website, kcrw.com/GLA. And subscribe to the podcast, too, while you're there. And, of course, you can get the podcast anywhere you get your podcasts. Juliana Mayo, Zeke Reed, Sonia Geis, Ted Robbins, Ray Guarna, Phil Richards, Amy Ta, Carlos Ramirez, Holly Adams, and Christian Bordahl all helped put the episode together this evening. I'm Steve Chitakis, honored by you listening to us tonight. And, of course, thank you for your ear. Have a great night.